They call him Doubting Thomas, singular, as if he's the only one who doubted. But I know better, because I doubted too. Maybe I should start from the beginning, but then maybe not. It's not important when I met Jesus or how I met him. It's that Jesus saw me. When you were with Jesus, he knew you. He understood you. He loved you. That's a feeling I'd never known before. That's why I followed him. I wasn't one of the inner circle. I still worked. I still went home at night. I still kissed my husband and kids in the morning. But more and more, I arranged my time so I could walk with Jesus, so I could hear him talk, learn from him. Even in Jerusalem, the week before, I don't know how to explain how that week felt. Excitement and joy and fear all intermingled in my heart and my head. I don't think I slept more than a few hours each night. Jerusalem is a big city, and I know there were many people there who didn't even know who Jesus was. But for those of us who loved him, it was extraordinary, until it was horrible. I think waking up was the hardest part. When I was asleep, I could pretend nothing had happened, that Jesus was still preaching and teaching, that the Romans hadn't arrested and crucified him. But when I was awake, well, all I knew was that all the color had gone out of the world. So when people began to whisper that Jesus was alive, I turned away, not for me, the gossip of foolish women. How many times did I decide to go out to find him and then retreat? 5? 6? It took all I had to go out for real. That last time to risk everything I had. All I can say is that in the moment when Jesus looked at me again, when he saw me again, then for the first time, I let myself hope.
I don't even know what to think, how to feel. This week has been exhausting, confusing, definitely emotional. I mean, Jesus told all of us that this was coming, his arrest, the trial, even his death. But of course, none of us wanted to believe him. How could we? It just didn't seem possible until it was. And suddenly, he was gone. It's been 3 days, and it still doesn't seem real. This morning, I went to the tomb to prepare his body. As I neared the tomb, I realized the stone had been rolled away, so I rushed inside to see. His body wasn't there. Where was it? So I ran back quickly to tell Peter, who came back with me, just as troubled and dismayed as I was. When Simon Peter realized I wasn't mistaken, he hurried back to tell the others at the house where they were hiding, concerned about the potential backlash. I assumed that he meant to... Sorry. I assumed he meant to tell the others that Jesus' body was missing, maybe even to enlist help from others. Weeping and devastated, I remained in the garden where the tomb was located. I saw a man who I assumed was just the gardener, so I ran up to him quickly and asked him, "Where is my Jesus? Where is Jesus' body?" And as I looked at him, he said my name. How did he know my name? And then I saw him. I mean, Jesus, right there in front of me. But it made no sense. He assured me that it was really himself. And then he told me to go back to the brothers and tell them that I had seen the Lord. So, of course, I quickly started to hurry back to the town, excited to share the good news with all of the disciples. I mean, I could hardly believe it. My Jesus was alive. But as I neared the town and started to walk through the market, I could sense all the sidelong, suspicious glances of the people. I could hear the whispers that suddenly were silent as I walked past. These people don't trust me. They have never trusted me. They certainly wouldn't believe me if I told them what had just happened in the graveyard. I mean, I can't really blame them. I don't think I would believe it either if it hadn't just happened to me. I suddenly put my head down and just kept walking, slowing as I neared the house. I took a deep breath and started up the steps. I kept wondering, would they believe me?
This has been a remarkable week, almost incomprehensible. I feel like I've been reeling from the events since they took our Jesus away and crucified him. I was devastated and afraid. What if the leaders chose to make examples of his followers too? The other disciples and I, we tried to keep a low profile and had gathered in a room in the city to comfort each other and tried to figure out what to do next. As we were talking on the first day of the week, Mary came to us. She told us that she had been to the tomb and had seen Jesus. He spoke to her and sent her with a message to us. We were stunned to even understand what this might mean. But in the evening, Jesus came to us too. He didn't even knock. He didn't come through the door. He was just there. Before I could be afraid, he said, "Peace be with you." I felt a deep sense of peace and calm. I looked at him in wonder. He showed us his hands and feet and side, and breathed his spirit on us. With his words, we realized what we needed to do next. We knew we needed to share this miraculous story with others and that God was with us. We all became so excited as Jesus left. We were exclaiming and talking over each other, and just then Thomas came in the room. I had forgotten that he had left on an errand and missed this whole thing. I quickly told him that Jesus had come to us. The others chimed in as well, but he simply shook his head and said that unless he saw and touched Jesus' wounds, he would believe it. I was annoyed. Did he think the rest of us were making this up? Had he not seen the miraculous things that Jesus did among us? I wish he wouldn't be so stubborn and could share the joy that the rest of us felt. Throughout the next week, we did remain joyous. Knowing that Jesus had overcome death, we continued discussing how to share this amazing story with others. But I wish that the teacher was still with us. He always had a way of putting things so that we could understand. Thomas remained aloof and was not excited the way the rest of us were. And I felt just a little sorry for him. And then suddenly, Jesus returned to us as he had the first time. He was there in the room. He looked directly at Thomas and said, "See my hands and feet? Touch my side." I was tempted to laugh because Thomas was so startled, but I managed not to. Jesus said to Thomas, "Do you believe because you have seen me? Blessed are those who believe who have not seen." I have to admit, I did feel a little guilty at hearing these words, because I'm not sure I believed when Mary first came to us. It is clear now what Jesus expects of us: to believe, to live in community as believers, and to share his teachings with others. Knowing the joy that I feel now, I can only imagine what that new life together will look like.
Sometimes when I look back, I'm not sure which miracle was the greater: Jesus coming back to life, or the followers of Jesus coming together, living a life transformed. I can't help wonder what our neighbors think. Who lives like this? Selling our property to care for the poor, sharing our food and our hearts and our lives, living with joy rather than fear? Our lives were so different now. One day, after Jesus left us while we were waiting in Jerusalem, I had lunch with someone in the inner circle. He told me about Thomas. Thomas, too, had doubted, and Jesus gave him what he needed, a reason to hope. It's easy to imagine Jesus tearing up when Thomas believed, but I don't think that happened. I imagine Jesus trying not to smile or even suppressing a laugh. When hope returns, how can you not be joyful? But then I imagine Jesus' voice turned serious. "You," he told Thomas, "believed because you saw. What about all those people who wouldn't be able to see? How would they find hope?" I think about that a lot. And I think about our neighbors down the street and the family two blocks over and the friends of friends. Every day, someone else comes up to someone like me. The ones who see us living differently. They're hesitant, not knowing what to ask, but they know what they want. They want what we have. They may not know his name, but they know they want Jesus. They can't see the holes in Jesus' side, but they can know what hope looks like because they see it in us. I don't know where this story is going to end. I don't know how many chapters or plot twists or sacrifices there will be. But I know one thing: since I saw Jesus again, the world is full of color.
If you know me, it will not surprise you that I find Thomas is the most sympathetic character in this story. Because all Thomas wants is proof. Wouldn't you? I mean, would you believe it if someone came to you and said someone you had seen die, someone you had seen been killed, that he was alive? Sure, those who followed Jesus had seen some remarkable, miraculous things. But this? And so Thomas had to see Jesus himself. But I'm not sure that's all there is to the story. As I try and think through, imagine what Thomas was feeling, I can't help but wonder if there was something more than just doubt. Maybe it was fear. Not the fear you're thinking of. There was that, right? The disciples are hiding in an upper room. They're hiding there for a reason. But that's not what I mean. I mean the kind of fear we've all felt. The fear that maybe something you hope for won't come true. Life as it is better than the pain of being disappointed. Even if the world you live in is bleak and colorless. Thomas could have believed his friends who had seen Jesus, but what if they were wrong? His heart had been broken once. How could he stand it breaking again? And so Thomas waited for Jesus to come to him. Only when he saw Jesus himself, and maybe reached out and touched Jesus, only then did he believe. We remember the story of Doubting Thomas. It's a story full of color and excitement, and he's even got a cool nickname. But that nickname makes us forget that Thomas wasn't the only one. The other Gospels made it clear. Other people doubted too. But then they saw Jesus and believed. And suddenly, to borrow a phrase, they saw the world in screaming color. Now I want to pause here just a second, because I recognize this story can challenge us for a moment. It can challenge some of us, because Thomas got a chance to see Jesus. And Thomas got a chance to see the wounds. And we don't. And we can't. And sometimes that's hard. All right. And I've talked about that in other places at other times here. And so I don't want to go back over a lot of that again, but I do want to make one point. For most people, faith doesn't happen in the eternal present. You don't get on your knees once and say, "I believe," and be done. Faith is a continual act of reaffirming and recommitting. Sometimes this happens when you are strong in your faith and you shout to the world. Sometimes when life is hard and you're not sure that you can believe today, it might be a matter of whispering that you think you believe, that you want to believe. Years ago, I went to Rwanda with the Presbyterian Peacekeeping Program, and I was blessed to sit with a circle of victims and perpetrators of the genocide there. On that sunny, slightly chilly afternoon in March, a perpetrator, right, that's a fancy word for killer, a perpetrator sat on a metal folding chair under a tree and talked with a woman whose husband he had killed. We leaned closer as the woman's voice grew quieter. Sometimes, she said, she could forgive him. Other times, she almost whispered, she could not. The perpetrator sat quietly for a moment. Then he looked up at her and at us, and he said to her, "Then my responsibility on those days when you cannot, is to sit and to wait patiently until you can forgive me again." I think that God sees doubt that way. God rejoices on those days when our faith is strong, but on those days when our faith is weak and we can barely whisper, "I believe," he whispers to us, "Then I will sit with you and wait with you until your faith is strong again." So if this story frightens you, as it occasionally frightens me, know this: God will sit with you and wait with you, no matter how long it takes. But this story, it's primarily a story about joy. The joy of seeing and being seen by the risen Christ. It's a story of conquered doubt and joy resumed. It's a story, in the words of the hymn we just sang, of Jesus offering to live in us if we will live in him. So it's a story of hope. But it's also a story that lays a claim on us. And to understand that requires that we keep reading past the book, end of the book of John and into the book of Acts. When we do that, we recognize that believing isn't just an emotional or intellectual commitment. It's seeing the world in a different way, to see it as it was meant to be, in all of its joy and hope and love. And it's living in a different way. When we read past the end of John and we read into Acts, when we go past Pentecost, we read the end of Acts chapter 2, and we see that the people who saw Jesus live differently, sharing with each other, caring for each other, loving each other. And then we remember, right? Because not all of the Christians we see in Acts 2 saw the resurrected Christ. All right? The text is clear. And in that, there is a charge on us. All right? How can people find hope? Well, they get to know Jesus. And how do they do that? By seeing Jesus act in and through us. So I want to share one more memory with you. Oh, 20 years or so ago, for about a decade, Grace Presbyterian Church had a relationship with St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church in Nairobi, Kenya. Some of you, I see, probably remember this. Grace sent people to Nairobi several times, and people from Nairobi came here. I was lucky enough to be one of those people who went to Nairobi. I went there twice, in 2000 and 2006. And I've got lots of great memories of that trip. I remember standing on a hillside, taking a break from building a chicken coop, and watching across to the crest of another hill and seeing a flock of ostriches crest that hill, and thinking, I swear I said this to myself, I ought to say, I guess we're not in Kansas anymore, are we? I remember there, we were going to a Bible study. They didn't tell us this Bible study was going to last 4 hours long. I love me some Bible study, but 4 hours is a tiny bit more than I can take. And on the way, we were all crammed into a small Toyota. And because I was the guest, I was in the back seat. And because it was a very small Toyota, my wife, Laura, was sitting on my lap as we drove through Nairobi traffic. I do not recommend this. And I remember taking communion at St. Andrew's and taking the cup and tossing it back and only then realizing that it wasn't juice in that cup, it was scotch. And I remember visiting an orphanage. It was an orphanage for children whose parents had died of AIDS and who they themselves, the children, were HIV positive. We went there both times. There were 13 or 14 or 15 kids each time. That orphanage was named Tumaini. And Tumaini is a Swahili word, and it means hope. Now, I want to be clear. The children who lived there, they didn't have the hope of surviving physically. If you are alive in Africa in the early 2000s, and you're not really wealthy, AIDS is not a disease that you survive. Right? But that didn't mean that that orphanage was wrongly named, because hope was everywhere. Right? At Tumaini, these 6-year-olds and 8-year-olds and 10-year-olds could hope that there would be somebody who would play tag with them and dance with them and laugh at the jokes that weren't very good. At Tumaini, those kids could hope that somebody would cut their sandwiches into squares or triangles, that they would ask the kids if they wanted seconds, that they would remind those kids to clear their places and to wash their dishes, because even though they were sick, they could still offer something back to the community they were a part of. Right? These kids could hope that when they were sick, there would be somebody who would bring them a glass of water, somebody who would put a cold washcloth on their forehead. Right? And those kids could hope, in those last few moments before HIV took their physical body, that there would be somebody there who would hold their hand and who would tell them, do not be afraid. Because the last thing is never the worst thing. And you never, ever have to be alone. So how are we? We who believe without having seen, how are we to live? I think we can learn something from the people at Tumaini, because we're called to be somebody's hope. Be somebody's hope. Sometimes in small ways, sometimes in big ways, but always be somebody's hope, knowing that in doing so, they can meet Jesus through us. Amen.